Okay, and we're recording.
If you'd tell me your name.
My name is Bill Quinnell. I have lived in New Milford since probably July of 1970. Certainly 1970 was July and August when I moved here. What brought me here was a job at Western Connecticut State University, which then began in September of that year. I was all of 25 years old, fresh out of graduate school at Temple University in Philadelphia with a master's degree in philosophy, and I had just finished all of my PhD coursework, had still to take my prelims, and had still to pass the French language test, which I never succeeded in doing. So I never finished my PhD.
Oh my gosh, all that work.
And I was hired into what was then the humanities department at, we were called Westcon in those days. It was actually Western Connecticut State Teachers College back then. And they had a core program that every student had to take that involved four separate humanities courses. And they were just beginning to develop a philosophy, what they hoped would evolve into a philosophy major. I think in 1970, that department alone hired six people. It's entirely possible they hired eight people. And there was this plan down the road to split us off into a philosophy department and a humanities department. Then times changed, and I think maybe 4 years later, at least half of those people were gone. All of us who came there at that time, myself included, assumed we would be there for about 5 years and then move on. I think 33 years later, we finally retired from the place. And my then wife and I looked at a couple of places to live. Was very quickly evident that given what I was going to be paid, New Milford was economically more plausible for us. And the first house we rented was from Bill and Mildred Phillips, who lived on Route 7 up towards Boardman, just past Boardman's Bridge, and they owned a house on 7 that distinctly looked like it might have, at some point in the 30s, been a little gas station. And they owned a house across the street that used to be a barn. Bill Phillips was born in the Bronx or Brooklyn or some impossibly unrelated to rural Connecticut place. But he was a mechanic. He worked for Kimberly-Clark as a mechanic working on their machines. Mildred was just a fantastic baker. So he was this handy guy. So he would collect houses. And the barn across the street he converted into, I think, two or three apartments. And this house that my wife and I rented was literally on the V corner of its 37 and 7.
Okay.
It was this old, I guess farmhouse was an old house. And I came from Philadelphia, where I grew up in a house that was one room wide and three rooms deep. And had this fantasy that an old historic home would be a wonderful thing to own. So we rented this old home. And the first thing that struck me was that all of the walls had wallpaper on them, which I thought didn't match with my impression of a charming old historic home until I would run my finger down the wallpaper and hear the plaster behind it trickle down. We rented there for a year. It convinced me the last thing I wanted was an old historic home. And then she and I moved up into the Muriel section. New Milford then was just a wonderfully rural little town. It was, for me, coming from a city of however many million Philadelphia was hard to get used to. Although, curiously, I just felt at home right away. I just somehow fit right into this. But I think I mentioned to you at the store, it must have taken me a year before I stopped locking the house when I went out to mow the lawn. If you just get into this mindset, living in a certain place for most of your life, these are things you do.
Right.
Do you just do this?
Right.
And then you get here and the crime wave is two bicycle thefts. Are we kidding or what? What is this? Is this Mayberry? Is it, what? But I remember some, I mean, there was a dairy farm within walking distance of where you and I are sitting now. I think it's Aspetuck Village is the name of the condos. They're across Wellsville Road from Canterbury. That was very much a working farm. The second years after my wife and I bought this house up in Muriel, it was not uncommon to come down Muriel Road and find a cow marching in the other direction that had wandered off from one of these places. One of my favorites, two of my very favorite spots in downtown in Milford was Young's Hotel, which had a fantastic restaurant. Great fish, just great fish in there. And slightly surly waitresses, but whatever.
Was it actually a working hotel?
Yeah, I think it was a work. I don't know if it was still a working hotel when I was. I can't answer that question. Okay. But the restaurant was very much alive and well. And Perry Green's Feed Barn, which was across the, you know what I'm talking about?
It's the old CM Beach building.
No, it's not. It's what is the inn. Not the homestead,
right next to the dry cleaners.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that was like walking into the 19th century. I loved that place. I'd go in there, whatever I needed for a law, even if I'd just go in there. And I would go in there just to talk to him.
What was he like?
Just to do this.
Right.
Well, he was, you know, he was born and raised here. He had stories of New Milford when maybe there weren't carriages quite going down Main Street, but we weren't too far removed from that. He was just this wonderful old guy. His office had this huge potbelly stove in it. Wood floors with planks like this. To my mind, utter chaos. And yet, Perry, I need 5 pounds of, and he could go right to it.
Right.
And I had this thing in his brain organized. He was a terrific old guy. I don't know how old he was when he finally passed away, because it struck me he was old when I knew him in 1970. So I loved that about him. It was just terrific.
I'm trying to think of some probing questions, just because you're the second person to bring up Perry Green. People have brought up the potbelly stove and the chairs around it and how it was a gathering spot. I don't know if you know Wynn Rogg.
Oh, yeah.
She talked about the smells.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, fresh hay and grass seed and fertilizer. My memory is that he had a horse he would drag out on the porch.
And the horse actually went missing for years after it closed.
Oh, really?
And it showed up in someone's basement. They found it. And now it's at the Historical Society.
Oh, man. He was a great guy.
What strikes me about New Milford is sort of how, despite the fact it really is an agglomeration of a bunch of small communities, right? So we have Mariel and Northville and Gaylordsville, and then Southern New Milford, which is, you know, Lanesville and a bunch of maybe the lake even. How there's really this glue that knits these communities together. And really, despite how large it is, it feels very small still in many ways. And I feel like a lot of this has to do with, you know, a lot of community organizations and civic life, and to a lesser extent, maybe, or even a larger extent, the pride that a lot of people have in being from New Milford, even though there's sometimes a sense of shame too. And one of the things that struck me, that like one of my favorite things about New Milford was the 300th anniversary, right? So this just sort of meeting of generations and memory and just civic pride, artificial or not. Is there something, some community event or something that you remember that just really touched home for you? Maybe touched home about the community or how New Milford is really a special place.
I don't think so.
Okay.
But what struck me right off the bat, I had been involved in politics in Philadelphia.
Okay.
Because I am a kid of the 60s. So
okay. Part of all that.
Anti-war, I did all that stuff.
Hence the Bernie Sanders love.
And in Philadelphia, you walked a line between that kind of democratic activism and the reality of city politics. And there is a reality of city politics. And I got myself to be within the Democratic Party a district representative. So the city is divided into districts, and within the districts, it's divided into subcategories based on streets.
Mm-hmm.
And I was at the lowest rung of this. It got me into the politics of city life. So part of the game was you got a parking ticket. I'm the person you called because you didn't want to pay your parking ticket. And you would swear up and down on your mother's grave that you were voting for whomever the Democratic candidates were, and I would take care of your party ticket. And I would duly note at least whether you got to the polls. I couldn't monitor what you did, but I knew exactly when you voted, how many times you voted. And we would go in, this other guy and I would go into the district office to the ward leader the night before every election. And he would sit behind this huge desk and he would say, what are the results going to look like? And you had to the best of your ability predict a certain sort of number, how it's going to go, what the numbers were looking like. And then he would take money out of his pocket. And this was allegedly for people who worked at the polls for you. You paid them. The party paid them. But nobody actually asked you what you did with that money. And that's the way it was. That's just the way it was. So I come up here. And first, there are town meetings. What? There what? There what? You know, the town shows up in the high school. Right? And they vote. Really? Where's the money? You know, I just don't know how to explain how, on the one hand, it was like, you're kidding, right? And on the other hand, it was, I can't get enough of this. I cannot get enough of this. This is too good. This is what it's supposed to be, right?
Right.
It's the closest thing I came to a sense that I had stumbled into someplace, at least at that time, it seemed like a historical throwback to an era that was much purer than what I walked away from.
Did you ever get involved in politics in New Milford?
Absolutely. The first thing I got involved with was a group called the Community Action Development Committee, run by a guy named C. Victor Brown, who was a minister, I think at the Congregational Church at one point, briefly, and he lived up off 67. And this was a movement to try to involve the community in developing plans for its own civic life, as opposed to having the hierarchy such that it was, develop those plans. And I got connected to the group that was studying education. Scaticoke was not built yet, but the plans were on the board, and the Board of Education had approved them. I got to know a woman named Barbara Hammond, who subsequently started the Children's Center, which is up on. She was a remarkable lady. Still is a remarkable lady. So that was my first entree, and then I served on a variety of other civic committees, and then joined the Democratic Town Committee and ran unsuccessfully for the town clerk's office against Mrs. Chapin and Lou White's, I think, second run for first selectman. in which, if I recall correctly, every single Democratic candidate except me won. I may be wrong that I was the only exception, but there were a damn few exceptions.
Don't worry, I'll look it up.
But that was a name I couldn't compete with. Anyway, it would have been not good for me to win that, because then I would have left Westcott and a whole lot of what I became wouldn't have happened. I served on the Zoning Commission. I served on the Board of Education. I was the chairman of the Board of Ed for a year. I served on the Board of Finance.
So what always strikes me about when people talk about politics in New Milford, especially in the 90s, is, you know, this idea of corruption, about developers controlling things and things like that. I mean, did you get a sense?
What you got a sense of when I got here, there was no zoning.
Okay.
So it wasn't the Wild West, but I mean, people were doing, you could do things that were not the best things to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
And my then wife and I bought this house up on, it's called Mount Time Road now. I think it had some crazy name like Falcarfay Drive. And these were not bad houses built on roughly an acre to less than an acre, in an area that would subsequently be zoned 2 acres. Somebody bought a bunch of acres at the top of that road and started putting houses in. And when you went and looked at them, you realized he was putting septic, he was drilling out stone and putting septic tank and drilled out stone. And that, you know, we sort of arrived at the time with an old Yankee attitude, it's my land, I can do whatever the hell I want to do with it. And this is a disaster. Somebody's being taken advantage of here. We're colliding. I don't, you know, was it worse than Tommy Pilla being accused of raping the town because he's building houses all over the place? I don't remember that it was.
Right.
But there was that. There was that Yankee attitude. This is, you know.
Were you part of the debate about zoning? Were you involved in that?
I didn't occur, never occurred to me there should be a debate. Of course there should be zoning. What's the debate? What are you talking about?
That's a really good point. Something nobody has talked about, and I'm just curious, like how did that? I mean, what was sort of the timeline with that? I mean, was the town resistant? I mean, if you remember.
I don't remember clearly. I remember the guy who. Did you know Jack Rudner?
I didn't. I don't.
Okay. I think he was the superintendent of schools at one point. I knew him. He was working at Westcon in the business office. I think it was the VP of finance or something like that. And he lived in New Milford. He lived in one of the roads off 202. And he chaired the zoning, the original zoning plans.
Mm-hmm.
I honestly don't remember what the impetus for all of that was. I'm guessing it was some of the development in the south of town.
Mm-hmm.
I'm guessing it was pushed by some of the nice folks who were moving into Marion, who were obviously not New Milford neighbors and who had a completely different agenda. And you alluded to this, but when you're looking for votes, it is kind of fascinating how the conversation you have down in Lanesville is radically different than the conversation you're having up on Aspetuck Ridge Road or Indian Trails Road. And it's, we're all in this together, I guess. Chris, don't remember what the push was.
That's okay. I mean,
I don't even remember that once the plans were on the board. It had trouble passing. I could be dead wrong about that, but
right.
I just don't remember that.
Was there anything that was sort of a culture shock to you besides, you know, having to lock your doors? Someone who I spoke with who came from even just New Haven, he told me about how, you know, dealing with these old Yankee farmers was just beyond difficult and mildly amusing at times. He actually, his house was built by the Doctor Brothers, and he had a stonemason come, and he had mentioned something, and the stonemason was so angry that the stonemason left and then showed up a year later to finish the work.
No, I don't have any of those stories. Was it Smirsky's? There's a farm up on Mariel Road. I think it's now part of the Weetabix Land Trust, somebody's land trust. Any rate, it was a working dairy farm. And I can remember going up there when my son was one or two or something crazy thing. And I don't know why Smirsky, that
Is it the one with the white barns right
on
on?
the left-hand side.
Yeah, that's the Smirskys.
So I go up there with my son because we just go up and look at cows. And old Smirsky was there one day, and we're just chatting with him. I remember saying to him, "So how does the milk you're producing here, raw milk, we're calling it?" I don't recall that he used that phrase, but I said, "So how's that taste different than the pasteurized stuff I get in the store?" And he said, "I don't know." Now I interpreted "I don't know" to mean I had somehow not asked the question clearly, so I try it again. And he says, "Well, I don't know. I've never had pasteurized milk."
Have you never heard anyone say that in Philly?
No,
So you became a photographer. And you had a it was your business did was your business located in New Milford, just running out of your house?
Just running out of my house. I mean, my principal photographic activity was all teaching at the school
Okay.
and making the kinds of images that were, for want of a better word, expressive, that were my impressions of what I saw. And if somebody ever bought one, that was thrilling. But basically, I filled up the space under my bed as all this work. So, if you get reasonably proficient, somebody has to take a picture of their kid. Or evolved into doing weddings and portraits. Actually, I did some small catalog work. The digital revolution put an end to all of that for me. Pretty much put an end to my wedding business too at this point.
Everybody has a smartphone. It's a shame.
It comes from both ends. Everybody has a smartphone, so that has the, I hear this great. I saw an American master's program on a photographer I'd never heard of in my life. It turned out he took a lot of famous photographs of Dylan and early folk rock people because he lived in the city. He did something completely different. He just happened to have a camera and loved taking pictures. So.
Right.
And he had this little pocket camera at the point they interviewed him, and he was flipping around. He said, "You know, back in the day, people would pay you to figure out how to coordinate an f-stop and a shutter speed, how to analyze depth of field, how to understand how the mathematics of that would work, how to push film or pull it." And he pulled out his camera and he said, "Now they figured out how to put Ansel Adams' brain in this thing, so nobody pays you for that
Right.
anymore." And that's pretty much what your smartphone did. The phone probably has as many megapixels as my Nikons. And also the pressure from the other end, all of the aftermarket stuff that you used to get money for.
Right.
That's right. And I regret, I mean, I'm not a business person. When I look back at how I ran that, it was all wrong. If I was trying to establish an active commercial studio, but that's not me. I'm too much a loner, actually. I mean, I don't mean that unkind. It's just me. I'm an only child. I function on my own. I think on my own. So, in retrospect, I needed people who understood marketing. I certainly needed people like the kids you have at the store who can make Facebook work, who can tweet. I can't do that. And I am not inclined to want to do that. But if you want to build a business in the 21st century, you need to be doing that stuff. So you need to be outside of you.
Right.
You need to understand what your abilities, interests, comfort levels, and where the line is, and where you need to find somebody who's on the other side of that line. And I never did that.
Do you think that the technology has hurt community in that way? Like, I mean, it's created sort of a digital community, but do you think we've sort of separated ourselves, I guess?
Yeah. You're asking me to be an old person. And
no, I'm not. I'm asking to be a philosopher, I guess.
I think it's absolutely true. I am just dumbfounded by the extent to which young people seem to not be able to function without a phone in their hand.
Right. And here we are recording this on a phone.
On a phone. Because it's a remarkable device.
Right.
But it's as, this is obviously not true to anybody, but I'm struck when I go to restaurants and I see young people and the first thing they do is drop the phone on the table. And, Chris, how are you? And what is this? I mean, how is this? What are you communicating?
Right.
I think technology, as I see it, drives us to be isolated, to be interpersonal in a very distant kind of fashion. It's not this way that we communicate. It's pushing that ephemeral object that we communicate. It seems to me, whether life evolves that way or not. I don't know.
I guess I'm intrigued by this because, and this actually just swinging back to like New Milford, and I guess not even New Milford directly, but just the idea of community and how the big part of this project for me is looking for community, right? So my mother grew up in New Milford or Bridgewater, but she spent a lot of time in New Milford because the towns are very connected. My grandfather spent a lot of time in New Milford from Bridgewater originally. But yet, and so I have this connection with this place. And yet, the community as it existed is no more because that thing, things change. And yet, in so many ways, I guess, I see the community still. And so I think, and there really is a connection, and I'm not sure if I'm being clear about it, but I think there's still, I don't know, I lost my train of thought, but it's a search for community. And I think that's really important. And I think if we stop and look for it and we stop and talk about it, it's really still here.
I don't see it so clearly.
Okay, please.
No, I don't see it so clearly, but what I was going to add is, but some of that may be a function of just age.
Mm-hmm.
That you know, what I don't see clearly is the place I just described to you, because that place isn't anymore.
Right.
I also have a different set of priorities.
Right.
I'm less inclined to be involved in all of those civic things, because a big part of me is thinking, how the hell do I get away from here for 6 months in winter?
Right.
So I'm...
And you just got in your job.
And I just got in my job. And when I announced to them I'm leaving for 6 months, they're probably... yeah. So it may be that just my orientation is now somewhere else. It's not, I've come here to plant roots. Okay, I planted roots, I grew whatever it was I grew, and now I'm dropping leaves like a fanatic and about to willow and die. I don't know if that's it, but I retain close to a bunch of older people.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I actually like about being at the North Hill store are the kids. Because were it not for this silly little job, I would not have that contact anymore. It's what Westcott did for 33 years. As I kept getting older and kept moving towards different horizons, I would continuously be exposed to people who were at the beginning of that process. And There's something good about that. Can drive you crazy. Can really drive you crazy. And because then you look back at that with a certain historical perspective that, of course, they don't have. That's how I look. I had a nice talk with Will, the tall guy in the deli. I worry about these kids. You and I alluded to this the other day, too. When I look at what technology does, is doing, the jobs it has eliminated and will continue to eliminate. You know, in your lifetime, that Bizzuto truck's going to show up without a driver.
I agree.
And so all of those guys who could support a family on the skills of driving a truck, they're gone. Well, what does that mean, they're gone? I mean, they just sort of vanished and floated into midair. Hardly.
Right.
And so when Will told me he's in his third semester at Housatonic, I think he said. Is that right?
No, he. I think he's. Is it Naugatuck? Is he?
Yeah, that's right. Naugatuck. And he clearly doesn't have much of a direction, but he likes to read and he's teaching himself to play the piano and all those things. And well, pretty much, I'm sure he's unemployed. There's a really nice guy who, and I can't picture what his world is going to be and what he has to do now to fit into it.
What would someone like him have done when you were that age?
Well, he could have taught himself to play the piano, going to work for the phone company, running lines somewhere and still taking piano lessons and supplied himself with a living wage and maybe decided when he was in his 20s, screw this, I'm going to go to school now. Where's he going to do that now? They're making a living wage at Northville Store? Are they going to be linemen? Hardly.
Right. Right.
So do you have a television?
I don't.
So find somebody who has a television and gets an absurd number of channels from. You can probably do this on your computer. Try to find Viceland TV.
Okay.
I'm now addicted to this thing. It, as far as I can tell, it's run by people your age. It has a very edgy, youthful, this is not your father's television show, documentary. Everything I've seen is a documentary.
Okay.
I watched an hour and a half last night of interviews with rappers in Miami. I am no more enamored by rappers or rap music than I am by hysterectomies. The interviews were all done by this little Jewish white guy who shows up, you know, surrounded by black teenage kids. It's some of the best documentary work there's a show called The State of Undress by some young girl that's about fashion. Like I would watch this one. Yeah, I can't take my eyes off it. Because she shows up in places like Mogadishu, Pakistan. And what starts as Venezuela, what starts as a conversation about beauty, gets into husbands throwing acids on their wives because they won't behave, back to beauty, back to trying to swim fully clothed. I mean, it's just remarkable how it's great TV. It's what you're trying to do here.
Right.
You know, just other parts of the world. I got to the rapper thing because I kept looking at, you know, these are South Chicago is like this wasteland, parts of Miami are this wasteland. But what I see are kids who have no opportunities. And what I fear is that's the world that Will's going to find himself in. But not black and not a rapper. But where are the opportunities? Well, Facebook. Can you develop the new Facebook? GoDaddy. Can you invent a new GoDaddy? What's your coding ability?
Mediocre.
So if the answer is that's not my world,
right,
and there are no drivers of trucks, and there are no linemen. I mean, I just can't, I don't know, I can't envision what their world's going to be.
And yet, I feel as though...
He, by the way, is solidly optimistic.
That's what I was about to say. It's very funny because I feel like his generation, and I guess I'm part of that generation too, although I don't feel very connected to his age bracket. They have this sort of follow your bliss mentality. Like, it's more important to find a job that makes you happy. And I guess actually I'm along with that too. I'm a historian, right? So find a job that makes you happy instead of finding a job that keeps you gainfully employed. What do you think of that?
I'm naive.
Yeah.
It's in the Edens of the world, it would be wonderful. But when push comes to shove, you got to put a roof over your head. You got to put food on your table. And if you have kids, you got to care for those kids. Period. Bottom line.
And yet you were a philosophy major, philosophy almost PhD. You were a PhD candidate in philosophy and a photographer. Just to change the world.
What are you trying to? You're criticizing inconsistency? But I would never venture away from that school because I couldn't. I mean, there are people who did. I'm not a risk taker, so that's the first one. But you know, it was always. That was an income that could put a half bread on my table and put
right.
It over my head, and I wouldn't jeopardize that.
And I understand, as someone who's looked at academia, I mean, it's changed drastically.
Oh.
And you and I have talked about that.
Oh, my God.
Depressingly so.
Oh, my God. It's awful. I was just look back and think I'm very lucky. I am who I am. I'm this sort of laid back, easygoing, float with the stream. Everything that's happened to me, good and bad, is stuff I fell into. I barely got out of high school. I'm dyslexic, so, when you say to me, what's the UPC code? You have no idea how many times I try to read that code to make sure it says 702, not 207, because I can do that without too much difficulty. And that's why when you say, well, read the sign, and I'm always looking for the package, it's a picture.
Right.
I can respond to the picture.
Right.
And if there's a hole there, that's not good for me. Anyway, so I barely got out of high school, but somehow... In my youth, I was connected to my church and to a lot of my friends who got really involved with religion. Actually worked in high school on the Billy Graham Crusade in Philadelphia.
Oh my gosh.
And I was good at what's going on now. I couldn't read, but I could verbalize. So very early, I think I was like 12, in Boy Scouts. The church that sponsored us always had a Boy Scout Sunday. And I ended up giving a sermon. And I guess it went over well. I got a lot of wonderful feedback from that. There was a guy in that church who a few years later offered to send me to college if I would go to a particular school. Like Bob Jonesy type place. I think so. Anyway, so I was going to be a minister, and the only school that accepted me was this little bitty religious college called Eastern Baptist College in a suburb of Philadelphia. It had 500 students in its big years. Transformed my life. I'd come from all these big city schools where I was pretty lost. Hard to get lost when there were only 500 of you. Started out in the remedial reading class. Was accepted on probation, so I had a limited number. And my best friends throughout college were all people I met now. We don't read that class. But it gave me support. Surrounded me with some terrific professors. I ended up, I was the president of the student body in my senior year.
Gosh.
It's, you know, I was lucky. And why did I go there? That's the only place that accepted me.
Right.
So now I think I'm going to go to, midway through there, I realize I can't be a minister because you got to be rational about things. This keeps getting in the way. I can't. Explain to me what the Trinity is again. Well, it's three people in one. Do you believe that? Well, maybe if I could understand it, I would know if I believed it, but I can't even understand it. So I kept going. I started to go around this circle of how do you believe what you can't understand? And does that even make sense? Does that question even make sense? Columbus discovered America in 1303. Do you believe that? Well, no, because I at least know what 1303 is and I can trace. And as a cousin of mine once said, I sort of lost that part, but I could never kind of jettison the interest in values and ethics and some sort of social responsibility for whatever reason it was. So if you promise not to actually repeat this.
You want me to shut it off?
No,
Okay.
this is just so stupid. It's embarrassing. So I'm in my senior year in college. Vietnam is roaring. It's 1964, when did I graduate? 67. I decide I'm going to apply to Temple University theology program to get a graduate degree in theology. Then maybe I can come back and teach it, at least have conversations about it as opposed to be a you need to believe this kind of person. Oh, and by the way, I might as well apply to the philosophy department too, because I got this degree. I get this acceptance letter, which I open it up from Temple, and it says, "Congratulations, you've been accepted." That's as far as I read, and I'm thinking, oh, I'm going to go to the theology program. Well, it's from the philosophy department. I never did hear from So I show up there, and I went from a school of 500. Temple had about 30,000 people at that time. Their graduate philosophy program was pretty new. I, as it turned out, was woefully ill-prepared for that kind of radical thinking. But once again, there were a collection of guys who were willing to hold hands. 3 years later, I end up at WESCO. Chairman of that department is a great amateur photographer. I don't even know what that fine art photographer. I'm not sure I know what that is. I know Wetzel Adams, of course. And he's going to have
But we couldn't remember Robert Frank.
And he was a little tiny guy. He photographed with an 8x10 Deardorff camera, which on its tripod easily had to be as big as he was. So he's going to have a show of his work at the Kent School Art Gallery. And I'm politically smart enough to know if my boss is showing his photographs, I am going. I'm still not sure what I'm going to see, you know. Wedding pictures, vacation pictures. Why would I look at that in an art gallery? He and his wife had their kids, and they would go to Europe almost every summer. I actually had it in my head. I'm going to see pictures of Dorothy, his wife, in front of their favorite restaurant, which is fine if we're around their dining table, but why am I in this art gallery doing that? Needless to say, there were no pictures of Dorothy. And I was just so blown away by what I saw there. It was the first time I understood how personal a photograph could be, how this machine could actually be used to interpret a vision, could be made personal. And I was just seduced. I fell in love with what he did.
you remember, was there a picture that really just.
There was no specific picture. Well, there was a picture of this young kid standing in front of a barn. And he's just looking dead straight into the camera, young kid, teenage kind of kid. And something about his skin and the texture of the barn and the severity of his look, and it's, don't know, it was Hal. It wasn't the kid, it was Hal. This was Hal. And it was going through a room of, wow, this is Hal. So the only hint I had in, you tell me to shut up when it's time, you know.
This is
That's
fine.
nothing to do with New Mumford and
It
Sons.
doesn't, but it's your story, so.
The only hint I ever had of a curiosity about art was in my last year of graduate school at Temple, and I was in a philosophy of mind class with this guy who was really good. And I would be sitting there writing poetry. That was terrible poetry. Had nothing to do with this class. It had absolutely nothing. It was the answer, as precise and concrete as he would be. I'd be writing these vaguer and vaguer. And so, you know, when I look back on it, photography is perfect. As a kid who's not stupid, but who can't read. So what's the vehicle? Images vehicle. So my photo business always was very secondhand to the reason I took pictures. I remember there was a maybe 2 or 3 year period after I discovered people paid you to do this, mentioning that, you know, do what you love and get paid for it. That was
Right.
the ideal state. When I realized that I just wasn't picking up a camera unless somebody was writing a check. And that wasn't good. It's not why I started this. And I started saying no to jobs. And it wasn't until I retired that I really picked up a lot of writing stuff. And learned how to not be commercial about it, to be a documentary photographer at this party. That was fun.
I was going to ask you, I mean, do you feel like there's a difference between the art and sort of this applied version of the art, I guess?
Well, I'm not sure I do. I don't know what I don't know what art is anymore, so let's ignore that part.
How philosophical of you. What is art, Bill?
Well, I mean, I think documentary work, photographs lend themselves to that sort of just storytelling, that descriptive thing. And I think the most interesting art stuff I ever did, thanks to the nice people at Pratt. There's another story. Did I tell you that one? I needed to get an MFA if I'm going to teach photography at Westcott. I'm 40 to almost 50 years old. I can't walk away from this job and say, okay, I'll be back in 3 years after I have my degree. That's not going to work. I need a school that's going to accept a part-time student. I found three in the area. Bard College. You ever been to Bard College? They had a summer program, 3 years. You spend your summers there, you walk away with it's self-directed, you walk away with an MFA. School of Visual Arts in Manhattan, really good place. And Pratt Institute in Brooklyn. And I only knew I found Pratt Institute when I discovered these buildings surrounded by razor wire. It's either a prison or it's a school. So Pratt was 10th on my list of three possible schools. What's the only school that accepted me? Bard, which would have been number one, would have been a disaster. Because I had spent probably at that point 10 to 15 years teaching myself, creating the aesthetic I wanted out of myself by mimicking people like Ansel Adams. Theirs was a self-directed program. I would have just continued to do what I was doing.
Right.
SVA would have been similar to Pratt. They'd have been good. But again, Pratt was, you know, they were hand-holding. And they just transformed me as an image maker. absolutely transformed me. So one of the things they insisted I do is get my brain out of taking pictures. And they would ask the question, this was my first semester there, so where's the photograph occur? Edward Weston, who was a classic black and white shooter in the 30s, had this phrase, pre-visualization. You saw the picture, finished product print, before you ever pushed the button on the camera. And that made sense to me, because you had to adjust an aperture, you had to adjust the shutter speed, you had to think about depth of field. And if you didn't know what you were trying to achieve, how could you do any of that? So I bought into this idea. And when I say I bought into it, I mean like I exclusively bought into that idea. So the first semester I have is this photo class. This guy's trying to get me to unbuy. What happens if you don't do that? And I'm at a loss. You can't do anything. If you don't do that, you can't do anything. And he says, you shot film in your lifetime? Yeah. Okay. So he says to me, do you ever notice that some of those frames at the very beginning that you were just advancing the film looked kind of interesting? Well, I'm not sure I ever paid any attention to those frames. His solution was to say to me, come back next week with three rolls of film you shot without looking through the camera. This was antithetical to existence. And I had such a hard time doing that, that the only way I could do it is if I was driving. Because even I was smart enough to know you can't drive and look through a camera at the same time. But even if I'd stopped at a light, that thing would be up in my eye and I just couldn't help myself. It was great. There used to be a store in Danbury called The Cows Outside. It was on Main Street.
Okay.
And like Perry Green, they had a wooden, in fact, maybe they stole Perry Green's. When they were open, they dragged this cow out on the sidewalk. I'm driving across White Street with this camera on the bench seat next to me. My eye catches the cow. I grab the camera. I go click. And then I finish the roll trying to do the same thing. You said to me, what'd you take a picture of? My answer is the wooden cow and the cows outside. When I processed the film and made the print, there was a wooden cow and the cows outside, or part of it. There was also the rearview mirror outside the passenger's door superimposed on the cow's butt. There was the car behind me in the rearview mirror. There was the mirror on the windshield, with an image behind that. There was part of the steering wheel. There was a bit of my hand. There was all sorts of stuff I never saw. I saw the cow. And right off the bat, it was like, wait, I was in exactly the same place this camera was. I didn't see any of it. Which, of course, then raises the question, how much more of your life is going by you're not aware of? I must have thousands of pictures, both taken from cars. And I was also going through my second divorce. So I decided, which came as a surprise to me. So I started this process of taking the camera, getting into bed, saying, okay, long exposure, I'm going to get out of bed and see what I don't notice. You get out of bed and you stumble to the bathroom, right? Mm-hmm. And they were just these crazy images of all this stuff in the process of stumbling to the bathroom that your brain pays no attention. Mm-hmm. So that got me into this whole thing of what does your brain decide isn't important that you've missed in your life? A series of photographs. I'm going out west. Just before I leave, I load a bunch of cameras in my truck. I'm going to spend 2 months on the road. Just before I leave, a friend of mine in Danbury's got a lab. Shows me this sort of panoramic picture. It's about this long. He says, you ought to take this camera with you. I said, what is it? It's a $9.98 plastic camera. So that shit, I can afford $9.98. I fell in love with it. You couldn't adjust anything. It just went click. I loved it. But I'm supposed to be an artist, so And what I love about the Southwest is these huge skies.
Very Ansel Adams.
So I'm shooting everything vertically. If it's supposed to be a panoramic camera, I can't shoot it that way. I'm shooting it all vertically. Mm-hmm. And I come back and I'm thinking, posters. Posters of New Mexico, and there's desert down here, and then it just gets gradually darker as we go from light to dark blue. Process, I mean, there are hundreds of rolls now. That's basically the only camera I used. I process all this film, decide to make a poster, size print. You could, and you had no idea what you're looking at. It was like gray blob. So I'd make it smaller. By the time it got so you could see what it was slightly, it was about this size. So here I was exactly in the position the nice people at Pratt wanted to put me in. Because when you were shooting like Edward Weston, what happens if the thing you execute doesn't match the thing you had in mind? Well, it's a failure. You throw it out. It's a stupid response, but that's part of the,
yeah.
Here's the criteria of what we're after. You didn't get there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm either going to throw out a couple hundred rolls of film, or, which is a lot of money, or I got to figure out what to do with these because this is never going to be a poster. And it took me about 3 weeks to a month before I started to make these composite images that were eight separate prints of exactly the same negative. Four of them straight, four of them flipped. Mattered together, so you had this, followed by that, followed by that. Showed that work in New York, sold a bunch of it. It was the artist side of me came closest right then and there.
It's pretty amazing.
It's wonderful.
I hate to cut you short.
I know, I keep blabbing away forever.
Oh, you could go on, but.
Yeah.